You're listening to a station that takes you off the beaten track from the University of Victoria, CFUV, 101.9 FM, 104.3 on cable, and on the internet, cfuv.uvic.ca.
CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable dial, and you know we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. Well, why do the marginalized voices addressing any number of issues and debates bother? Why, when a single article in the state corporate media can generate a greater readership than a year of efforts by street papers, internet news sites, or blogs, do journalists, citizen journalists, and the myriad volunteers in a plethora of organizations continue to devote uncounted hours of service to the cause? Perhaps part of it is because they believe if only the people knew of the gross injustices allowed, done in the name of corporate profit maximization and government's failure to enforce the law, they would stand up and demand a stop be put to egregious criminality and the impunity its perpetrators enjoy. Alison Weir is a freelance journalist and lecturer due to speak here in Victoria Thursday at the BC Government Employees Union Auditorium on the topic, If Canadians Knew, Israel-Palestine Beyond the Headlines. Alison Weir in the first segment. And Friday, Victorians were treated to the pomp and circumstance of the running of the Olympic torch through the streets and byways of the city and environs. If the hypersecurity employed to protect the procession is any indication, the bloated billion-plus police and military budgets allowed for the Vancouver Games will likely balloon into the stratosphere, just as the overrun cost for the 2010 version of the greatest circus on Earth already has. In recent years, Olympic excess, in all possible definitions of the word, has many opposed to the prospect of opening the public purse for the private pursuit of profit, only to bear the huge financial, social, and environmental costs the modern spectacle levies. Zoe Blunt is with No2010Victoria.net, and she and a few hundred kindred spirits got together in downtown Victoria on Friday to give voice to those concerned about the dark side of the Olympics movement. She's also a Langford-based pro-activist, freelance journalist, wilderness and environmental educator, and was intimately involved with the recent Torch welcoming reception. Zoe Blunt and Victoria bidding aloha to the Torch in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV broadcaster Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour to keep us current on an extraordinary week in the streets of Victoria. But first, Alison Weir and telling what, if only, Canadians knew about Palestine. Stick around. Well, welcome to the program, Alison.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Of course, now, Alison, the Goldstone Report is currently in the headlines. What's behind those lines?
Well, there's a great deal. This is the United Nations fact-finding report into what was really, you know, they're calling it the Gaza conflict or the Gaza violence, but it was really a very one-sided slaughter is the word that would probably be the most accurate, in which about 1,400 Gazans, men, women, and children, were killed in the space of just 3 weeks by what is the fourth or fifth most powerful military on the planet. During that time, the Gazan resistance fighters, of whom there are actually very few and have very little weaponry, killed about 9 Israelis. So the number was about 1,400 to 9. And of those 9, 5 were invading soldiers. So we're down to 4 that were actually in Israel. And of those 4, only 1 was a civilian. So Goldstone was charged. He's a well-known international jurist from South Africa. He himself identifies himself as very pro-Israel, as a Zionist, somebody very supportive of the Jewish state of Israel. he was charged with looking into any war crimes committed during that period of time, during those 3 weeks. He looked at both what Palestinians had done and what Israelis had done, and ended up with a almost 600-page document detailing massive killing of civilians by Israeli forces.
Well, and
targeting of civilians, targeting of schools, of hospitals. It's a very powerful report, and now, of course, the United Israel is trying to block it from being considered, with some success, I'm afraid.
Well, now, Allison, the Goldstone report, he also charged that Hamas, the political ruling party in Gaza, with war crimes as well. What about this now? I mean,
to keep in mind, he did. He definitely seemed to, the commission did look at war crimes committed by both parties in great detail, and they did find that the fact that Gazans, some of them, had fired unguided homemade rockets toward Israel, because these were unguided, did not have guidance systems, that is illegal. That is a war crime. It's illegal to do that. However, they did that because they have no guidance systems. They don't have the F-16s that the United States government gives them, for example. So it's really the only weaponry they had to try to defend their population, with very little effectiveness. But it certainly, he did note that, and he did note that this was a criminal action of Palestinians to do that. So he certainly accurately described illegal actions among both parties.
But is it accurate to say that Hamas was behind those rocket attacks, or is it more likely that there are factions that either are trying to undermine Hamas that may well have been firing some of those rockets, or just freeboot individualists that are making these things in their basement and fire them because they're angry about their grocery store being blown up or their uncle being murdered? What evidence is there that there was an organized effort by Hamas to use these Qassam rockets?
I think your suggestion is correct, that there are, you know, again, we have to just picture one of our densest cities being invaded by a foreign force with massive tanks and jets and helicopters and drones, all targeting our population. Some of our citizens would try to defend themselves. Some would, you know, maybe the official resistance groups would do, some maybe we would recreate those. There would be great chaos. So often, these rockets are fired by groups that have nothing to do with Hamas. Hamas has had long periods of a unilateral ceasefire in which it has committed no violence against Israeli forces, even though Israeli forces literally invade several times a day. You know, though I think the last few days they invaded about 20 times a day. Are raided by Israeli forces.
Yeah, well, this is something, Allison, that people here really aren't aware of, and that is the day-to-day life for Palestinians, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, and in Jerusalem, for that matter. We see the rock throwing, we see the jets sometimes attacking, but we don't see what it's like to live day-to-day under the heel of the Israeli Defense Forces. You've been there, Allison. What is it like living there day-to-day?
I think it's hard for people to imagine what it's like to have really no control over your own life, to have no power to protect your children. So what you find when you visit there is that in the West Bank, for example, if you want to go to the next town, to the hospital, if you're a woman who needs to deliver her baby and you want to go to the hospital to deliver your baby, or if you're a student trying to go to a university, or a person trying to go to their job in the next town, quite often there are Israeli soldiers in between. These are called so-called checkpoints. They're hostile soldiers from a foreign nation in the middle of your land, preventing you from going to the next town. So in a number of cases, the babies have died, when they were trying to get to the hospital to deliver the baby, the baby dies because they're not allowed through the checkpoint. In some of these cases, the mothers themselves also died because they were not allowed to get through the checkpoint to the next town. And I'm not talking about going through the border from the West Bank to Israel or from Gaza to Israel. I'm talking about within the Palestinian territories, going from Ramallah to Al-Bire, another little place near it, or from Jenin to Nablus, or from little villages outside of these cities, or from Bethlehem to Ramallah. These are all Palestinian towns. They're all on land that is recognized as belonging to Palestinians. It's called the Occupied Palestinian Territories. And yet, you cannot travel from place to place quite often because Israeli armed soldiers with in combat gear, with machine guns, prevent you often from going. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're a successful businessman who maybe is a lawyer or a doctor, or if you're the poorest farmer just trying to get your crops in to sell them somewhere. Israeli forces have complete control over you. If they decide at one of these checkpoints that they're going to strip search your children, they can do that, and they do that. If they decide that they are going to, quote, arrest you, but remember, this isn't an arrest. This is, you know, a foreign nation in the middle of Canada saying, okay, we don't want you to go to the next town, so we're going to put you in one of our prisons. It's just astounding what's going on there. I still, even though I've now seen this many times, I first began to learn about this issue about 9 years ago. I'm still astounded at what's going on and how covered up it all is.
Well, astounding, too, a couple of months back, before the Goldstone report made world headlines, there was some other reports beginning to come out in Sweden about organ harvesting going on, Palestinian organs being taken by persons within Israel to be used and sold on the transplant market, both within Israel and possibly abroad. You released a report at the end of August detailing this. This is a pretty shocking charge, Allison. What's behind this?
It's extraordinary. And I actually just wrote another one that came out, I think, about a few weeks ago, 4,700 words worth of an article looking into Israeli organ harvesting. That consists of many things. Some of it is this illegal trafficking in which traffickers go to the poorest populations on the planet, and of course some of those are the Palestinian population. But they go to Moldova, which is the poorest country in Europe, where people are living sometimes on $2 a day. They go to the poorest neighborhoods of Brazil. They've gone to China. And they're basically, these traffickers go to the most desperate people and offer them money for a kidney or a lung or perhaps part of your eye, organs that people can be induced to sell to these traffickers. So that happens. The number one country that of trafficking is Israel. It's been doing this for many years. From a number of years, these traffickers were being funded by the Israeli governmental system, by the health system there, and at times with complicity by the Ministry of Defense. It's really it's just such a tragic and horrible system. In many cases, these extremely poor people are induced to sell one of their organs, and then afterwards, often they don't even get the money that they were promised, or they only get a small portion of it, or they're just abandoned. There's no follow-up care for them. So they end up, this is often tracked with great detail. Nancy Shepherd Hughes is really the world expert and has testified before the U.S. Congress about all of this. There are many places that have documented this. So these people end up with minus a vital organ, months down the road with less money than they had to start with, because in many cases they either did not get the money or it quickly goes because they're not able to work. Their physical condition is so bad that they can't even do the the kind of manual labor that they were doing up until that point. Psychologically, they're devastated. Socially, they're devastated. It's a horrible system. Almost every country on earth has made it illegal to do this. Israel very belatedly last year finally appears to have outlawed it, but it still goes on to a considerable degree. Then on top of that, it turns out that that Israel's chief pathologist for a number of years had been taking body parts from the bodies that were in the state morgue. These were of Israelis and Palestinians. He was doing this without permission. He was at times giving these organs to other parties in exchange for money, in other words, selling them. This was a scandal for a number of times in Israel. He kept getting out of it. And finally, he was removed from being in charge of the state morgue, but he's still the chief pathologist, and according to an article that just came out in the Israeli media a few days ago, I think it was, he's the highest paid official in Israel, this man Yehuda Hiss, who's been dealing body parts.
Well, when
it's a bizarre situation. I would never, some of us had heard some of these allegations about Palestinians being injured by Israeli forces. Then the Israeli forces take these injured people, their families about 5 days later or a week later finally get their young men back dead with a suture, with this crudely stitched up incision, basically from their navel up to their chin, that they've allegedly been autopsied. So there's been this kind of evidence. A Swedish reporter is the person who actually first wrote about the subject a few months ago, back in August, and was immediately attacked by Israel and by Israel's defenders around the world, especially in the United States. He was called an anti-Semite. People, you know, Israel's defenders were saying this is, quote, the new blood libel against all Israelis and against all Jews. Just an over-the-top reaction. I decided, I read the article with interest. I had, as I said, I had heard some of this type of thing. I decided to investigate it myself and found considerable evidence for what he was discussing in his article. And the conclusion of his article was that this should be investigated, that nobody can really know the extent of what's been going on, but there's enough important evidence and indications that there's something very troubling that he called for an investigation. And like all the investigations, Israel is doing its best to block this.
Well, there's indications, like with the Goldstone report in the United States, that the American administration, I'm not aware that they have as yet denounced Goldstone, but the rumor is that the Obama administration will denounce the Goldstone report. There's an unnaturally close connection between the U.S. and Israel, and when it comes to policies, it leaves a lot of people scratching their heads. You wrote an article recently about Obama signing over subsidies to not the American dairy farmers, but to Israeli dairy farmers. What's that about, Allison?
That was very troubling. Again, much of this is covered in the Israeli media. A lot of my information comes from the Israeli media and sometimes the excellent Palestinian media. This particular story I saw in the Israeli wire service, YNET, that Obama had signed a memo that was exempting Israel from the requirement to pay a fee on their export of dairy products to the United States. Dairy farmers have been very hard hit in the U.S. in 2009 and before, but especially this year has been a crisis for them. Many farmers have lost their farms. They're going out of business. It's been extremely difficult for them. And here in the middle of this extremely difficult time for farmers to earn a livelihood, to hold on to their family farms, I discovered that Israel had made it even more difficult for them, because now Israeli dairy products will be able to compete with them very effectively, because Israel's products are often highly subsidized by the Israeli government. In fact, Israel already has a wonderful trade balance from their point of view with the United States, in which I think it's, I don't remember the numbers right now. I just looked this up a few days ago, but the United States imports from Israel much more than we export. And this, of course, benefits Israeli citizens and harms American citizens. And yet the strange change had just gone through. None of the American media were reporting it, or have reported it, in fact. I called the Agriculture Department that's supposed to be in charge of this. I talked to person after person. No one had heard of it. I talked to the Commerce Department, the Trade Department that's supposed to be also in charge of it. None of them had heard of this. It just slipped basically under the table. And, you know, Israel, the person who succeeded in pushing that through the U.S., the Israeli man, I think it's Mr. Butch, was the person who took credit for what he had accomplished, was quoted in the Israeli media, very proud of what he put over on Americans. But it's not in the New York Times or NPR.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet around the world. I'm speaking tonight with Allison Weir, and Allison is a freelance journalist and lecturer. She's due to speak here in Victoria this coming Thursday, November 5th, at the BC Government Employee Union Auditorium on the topic, If Canadians Only Knew Israel, Palestine, Beyond the Headlines. Allison is also the author of the website, ifamericansknew.org. Well, when you talk, Allison, about the trade imbalance between the United States and your country and Israel, that doesn't include, I'm assuming, the massive military exports that America sends to Israel every day of the week. What's the nexus of the military and aid connection between Israel and the United States?
Well, again, it's just astounding. The American taxpayers give Israel about $7 million per day of our tax money. Currently, it used to be half, quote, foreign aid and half, quote, military aid. But there's really no oversight in what this is. There are no strings attached. There's no way that this is being followed or monitored at all. It all typically goes to Israel right at the beginning of the year, which means that since the U.S. has been operating at a deficit, we are paying interest on the aid that we have given to Israel, and they are gaining interest. So in some years, according to people that have analyzed this very closely, it's costing the American taxpayer about $15 million a day to support Israel, a nation that has about 6 million people and is about the 17th wealthiest population on the planet. It makes no sense whatsoever. In addition, the military aid, normally U.S. military aid abroad, has the requirement that aid be spent on in purchasing weaponry from United States companies. Of course, the idea is that that our aid would at least benefit our economy somewhat. Well, once again, we see an exception for Israel. Israel is the one country on earth that can use a substantial portion of this money to basically fund a competing weapons industry that often takes jobs away from Americans because it's funding an industry that's competing with the American industry. Moreover, on top of all that, so now that's about $7 million per day. As I say, it often costs citizens of the United States about $15 million per day. An economist a few years ago looked into the total cost to the American economy of supporting Israel for the last approximately 60 years. He counted the direct aid, but also these additional losses to our economy because of the interest we're paying on money that we've given to Israel, because of the damage to the U.S., because of a number of boycotts against American companies, because of our support for Israel. In the end, he figured that it had cost the U.S. economy $3 trillion. $3 trillion, a massive amount of money for a very tiny nation that basically, in the balance of things, does far more harm to and for Americans and the U.S. than we get in return. So we lose $3 trillion, and we basically have almost nothing to show for it other than increased violence in the Middle East, increased hostility to the United States, increased tragic deaths among Palestinians and Israelis, and many other people. Lebanese has suffered. Israel has invaded Egypt. It's just a conflict that's tragic, that's one of the longest on that has been going on such a long time, and that could end once American taxpayers learn these facts, once more of the world learns what's going on, and our governments start requiring Israel to obey international law.
Well, it has to start somewhere. I thought that when the new president, Obama, was in the Middle East, if he had have gone to one checkpoint with the international press, things in Israel-Palestine could change immediately. But, of course, that didn't happen. Allison, sadly, we're out of time tonight. But for those wanting to hear more, and there is so much more to hear, Allison will be again here in Victoria this Thursday, November 5th, at the BCGEU building for her speech, If Canadians Knew, Israel-Palestine Beyond the Headlines. And you can check out Allison's website, ifamericansknew.org, a veritable wealth of information there as well. Thanks a lot for coming on the program, Allison.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, my great pleasure, of course. Now I'm going to take a brief break, but when I come back, I'll be joined by Janine, and she's going to bring us up to speed with a recap, I think, of what was going on in Victoria's streets in the week past. So do stick around for that.
Tune in to CFUV on Wednesday, November 11th at 10 in the morning for our tribute to victims of war. We invite you to listen to a special four-hour program of readings and music, old and new, for Remembrance Day.
Welcome back to CFUV 101.9 FM. This is Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking now, as oftentimes I do on this program at this time, with Janine Beckroft. Hey, Janine.
Chris, did you enjoy the Friday torch relay?
Well, yeah. Well, if you mean did I enjoy the march, yeah. It was the most interesting march I think I've ever been on, and I've been on quite a few. It was by parts tedious, tiresome, and absolutely fascinating and terrifying at points as well.
Yes, it was all of those things. And, you know, it's interesting how I think the most interesting thing for me was how the police that were with us all day at Centennial Square through the music and the speechifying and the anti-poverty Olympics that came over from Vancouver. And remember, you and I had talked about that as an idea several years ago. And so obviously, as you mentioned earlier, good ideas take on a life of their own. And so we had entertainment, and we had an opportunity to get to know each other, and we had 50 cops. I think somebody counted at one point 45 or 50 cops watching all of this, and then they marched along with us. And through the streets and for hours and through the rain, and was then joined by their horse team, and which I thought is just cruelty to animals. But then what was interesting when we got to the legislature and we were met by another group of police, RCMP this time, who were new. You know, they didn't know us. They didn't know what we were up to. They hadn't hung out with us all day and probably having a lot more fun than the, you know, the people who were with us probably had a lot more fun than the people who were with the torch run, I'm thinking. But and these new guys sort of pushed their way into the crowd, and they singled out the guys with the masks, and, oh, I'm going to keep an eye on you. And I thought, wow, you know, it's like, you know, we have a tendency to generalize about cops, and then they have a tendency to generalize about us. And really, you know, we're all individuals, right?
I'm not.
I know that. But and we do have a tendency to forget, like, you know, all this work that we've been doing all these years. It was a getting together of all sorts of different energy, and I heard stories about police officers, you know, people taking them aside and comments from them saying, well, you know what, I agree, this is a big waste of money, like they don't need to have all of us here, and you know, positioning some of the protesters so they could be in the photo shoots. They didn't shut down our right to hold signs as the torch went past or anything like that. So what were some of the things that you enjoyed?
Oh, well, I got to carry the torch. That was the highlight for me, because there was this massive torch on a hospital gurney, a wood paint and sculpted affair. I thought it was a much nicer looking torch than the official one. But some of the guys, it was quite heavy, and they needed a hand taking it down the steep staircase at the Bastion Square. And so I got my little bit of glory there. But yeah, it was amazing going down Cook Street. And this is after dusk. And there was a lot of people there on the streets, because they'd been told that this was the route the torch was going to take, and right into the heart of the Cook Street village. And instead of the torch, the police had radio communication, and so they found out we were there, so they went somewhere else. And when these people realized that they weren't going to see the handoff of the torch, instead they were going to see 500 people with bands playing and yelling and hooting and costumes and everything, which I would have thought would have been a much more interesting spectacle than just, two people, lighting a torch and then running away. But there was a bit of hostility there, but that was the highlight for me. And of course the horses, as you mentioned, and the helicopters and the dozens of police cars, and I counted 50 police in the Centennial Square before we left. And as you say, most of them were in the crowd, sort of in the march, which was a first for me. And we didn't have our bicycle, our Victoria PD bicycle patrol, which we usually see accompanying marches. They, as it turns out, were off with the torch. But yeah, it was quite a day, and my feet were killing me for a couple of days afterwards.
Oh, it was exhausting. I mean, people were out there right from the early morning. And, to read this one Times columnist article, I mean, we had no violence, from what I understand. There was no violence. There was one crazy guy who went and running up to the quilt shop, little locally owned quilt shop, and was banging on the windows, but I'm guessing that was a provocateur. And also, there was the marble release. The Times columnist makes it sound like we're all intent on having horses break their legs. We did not throw marbles at the horses. I was standing right there when some idiot, and again, I think it's a provocateur, somebody who isn't thinking properly, just sort of dropped marbles onto the street. And all of a sudden, my friend and I were talking, and we went, "Oh, what's that?" And there are all these marbles. I don't know, a couple of handfuls of them. They certainly weren't thrown. And we were right at the back, and I just looked at the horses, and I thought, oh, crap, like, this is not going to do any good. You end up with horses down on the road. Like, what? That doesn't do anybody. I mean, they don't want to be there any more than, And so we made sure to make a bit of noise about this is not a smart thing to do. And there were police officers, of course, right there, and they saw this, and they, went and talked to the horse people. And I think actually at that point they ended up going around the block. I'm not sure exactly what happened. But nobody got hurt, and I think it would be especially interesting if we could find out who put those marbles down, and if we find out that they're one of the planted provocateurs, there to incite violence and create trouble, and then connect that to the Times columnist article that says we threw them at the horses. I don't know. I'm not that investigative of a journalist myself. I'm busy putting the street news together. But, you just wonder. You wonder who. I think you had an incident too, didn't you, where one fellow wasn't making much sense?
Well, I was next to, whenever I see people that are, their identities are hidden, I get suspicious. And I remember what happened in Quebec with the Sûreté police, the Quebec police that had sent a few agents provocateurs into the crowd. And these were caught out and on video identified. There's three of them, and which they were trying to incite violence in a riot. One of them was carrying a mucking great rock that, I don't know what he was planning to do with that, but he got caught out, before it could happen. But I was next to one guy that was just screaming, "Cops suck," and "Cop, fuck off," and all this sort of stuff, in the face almost of the police. And which I thought, what the hell is that, And I did say to the guy, "Look, if you got a mask on your face, I don't know who you are, and I don't, you got no credibility with me." And the guy goes, "Yeah, but we're gonna win," and which seemed like a really weird thing to say to me as well, like, win what, But yeah, otherwise, yeah. And I wrote a piece at Pacific Free Press after this, on Friday evening, and I didn't go into that sort of aspect of it. But you know, it's I have to, you know, I said that the police had this was new to me at least, a strategy of walking with the crowd and so forth. And it was intimidating. These guys are heavily armed and they're huge guys and girls. And, you know, I had to wonder, what would it be like if there were 50 people that were openly armed and legally armed amongst the protest? How would that change the dynamics? You know, everywhere we go, we see these police who are looking more and more like soldiers every day, armed to the bloody teeth. And, you know, I don't find that comforting for my security. You know what I mean?
Oh, no, not at all. They were a pretty scary bunch. But
they were very restrained.
Helicopters overhead. And then there were the undercover ones that were sort of wearing the gray suits along the route.
But there was nothing happened that I could see. There was no heavy-handed stuff. And, I mean, it was a very intimidating experience for sure. But, you know, one little thing, and that could have, you know, I mean, there wasn't any Darth Vaders or anything around that I could see, although I imagine they were in the wings somewhere, but, you know.
People weren't looking for them. I don't think they were there. And and we did have the legal observers, right? The Pivot Legal Society, David Eby and them, they sent over they did training. People from here went over to Vancouver and got legal training for rights, and they were taking notes and getting names and numbers of the police officers. I think they got all their names and numbers.
And they did file a report saying that things went well, although some police weren't wearing their identification, or at least visibly. But they, you know, that was the BCCLA. They gave what I thought was a pretty good report for the police involved as well. So, of course, you mentioned the Times. You know, we only got 30 seconds, Janine, but the TC story that you mentioned, I read as well, and they said there was 200 people. That's wrong. I won't say it's a lie, but I'll say it's wrong. And they said there was, I can't remember, I won't quote it, but they downplayed the number of police, which I don't know why they would do that, probably just because, you know, the costs of this is just astounding. And they did leave the impression that, you know, they started off the article by saying, well, what started out as being peaceful became a little edgy or something, but it never became non-peaceful, although that's what the article suggests, although that is entirely untrue. But then again, you got to think, well, if they're writing their BS, then we're doing something good, forcing them to, you know, invent these articles, these so-called journalists.
Well, and luckily there's more and more of our press, you know, of what went on, the people who were there all day who can tell you what actually did go on. And you're going to be talking to Zoe, one of the organizers.
Right.
And I just want to let people know really quickly, Chris, that on Saturday, this very Saturday coming up, November 7th, they're having a fundraiser for some of these indie media filmmakers. I'm not sure if it's specifically for indie media, Victoria's Indie Media, or if it's going to be distributed among some of the other indie, you know, the B Channel. Oh, yes, it is, it looks like. Other alt media networks as well. So come on down to the Solstice. And there's going to be Without a Net, and Joey Only is going to be there, and Tempest, and it's going to be an opportunity to raise some money for local independent media activists.
What day is that again?
That is on Saturday, November 7th.
At the Solstice.
What time, you're asking me? I don't know. I think probably 8 o'clock or something.
I'll go early if you want to see. The Solstice isn't all that big. Okay, Janine, Street News is, as you say, you're getting ready for the December issue early, and your show, Winds of Change, alternating Thursdays at 11 a.m. right here at CFUV. Thanks for coming on again, Janine.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay, and as Janine mentioned, I'm going to be speaking a little bit more about this Olympics torch and the Olympic Games generally and the effects that it's having around here with Zoe, who's a great friend of the show and been on many times before. But before I do that, I'm going to treat you to this.
Still don't
back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca everywhere else around the world. Behind me, the new disc here in the studio, Mad Love, the band White with Foam, the CD. Well, in recent years, Olympics excess, in all possible definitions of the word, has many opposed to the prospect of opening the public purse for the private pursuit of profit, only to bear huge social, financial, and environmental costs, the modern spectacle levies. Zoe Blunt is with No2010Victoria.net, and she and a few hundred kindred spirits got together in downtown Victoria on Friday to give voice to those concerned about the dark side of the Olympics movement. Zoe is a Langford-based pro activist, freelance journalist, wilderness and environment educator, and was intimately involved with the recent Torch welcoming reception. Welcome back to the program, Zoe.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
I'm most happy to do it. Well, you're a little faint there, Zoe. If you get your mouth closer to the piece. Okay, Zoe, so I guess by way of post-mortem now, Janine talked a little bit and set up a little bit about what was going on at the march from her and my perspective. You were intimately involved, as I say, with organizing it. What are your impressions of putting this on and how it went?
It was a really great crowd. We had hundreds and hundreds of people out. It was an extremely diverse crowd. You know, we had representatives from all kinds of communities across Victoria and across the region. So we felt it was a really great success. People were in high spirits, and we've been getting hundreds of congratulatory messages since Friday thanking us for standing up for Indigenous rights and free speech and human rights and against poverty.
Well, yeah, you know, I mentioned to Janine that I'd written an article, and it had got quite a few comments, and they were varied, but some of the ones that were a little quizzical, and they were saying, well, you know, we got caught up in the traffic jam, and how do they expect to gain allies when they piss us off, basically, was the sentiment. What were the goals and of the march overall, Zoe, and what about the tactics? What about this point that, well, if you tie somebody up on their way home from work, they're just going to be pissed off and they're not going to listen to you?
Right, yeah, I know that some people are more dedicated to their driving speed than they are to social justice, and that's, you know, it's unfortunate that there's a lot of people in society who feel that way. There are people who try to convince us that it's useless to protest, that you can't fight City Hall, we should all just lay down and let them run right over us because, why, you know, it's wasted effort. I don't agree, a lot of us do not agree, that, you know, we think it is extremely useful. In fact, it was crucial for us to stand up the way we did. People in this community have been harassed by the intelligence police. They've been harassed by the RCMP just for being critical of the Olympics. You know, people in this community are suffering on the streets for lack of services. And, you know, even some of these Olympic torchbearers and these well-off people in Rockland might someday find themselves on the streets too. And we think that, you know, flashing programs that help people's quality of life in the long run, you know, that deserves a lot more protest. I think everyone should get out and stand up for something that they feel is important. I do know that, you know, though, a lot of people just are not that concerned about social issues and are more concerned about getting down the street, you know, instead of waiting a few minutes for people to express themselves. So that's too bad.
Mm. Yeah, well, and now, of course, the message now, Janine mentioned the Times Colonists article in Saturday's newspaper about the march. Did you see it?
I did, but refresh my memory. What, was there some controversy about tactics or strategy?
I didn't read any of that, although it was a rather snotty-toned article.
Oh, yeah.
It was written by two women whose names I've immediately forgotten. But
Katie DeRosa was one of them.
There you go. And basically, they said, first of all, that there was a couple hundred people. I was there, and I estimated 500, give or take.
Right.
They said, I can't remember, they said there was 2 dozen police or something, which was kind of laughable to me, because I counted 50 in the centennial, but then there was police cars, there was helicopters, there's horses, and I wasn't, and I didn't even make it as far as back to the legislature. My dogs couldn't take care of me that far, but, they mentioned
riot squads, there were undercover officers. You know, there was all kinds of stuff going on behind the scenes
Well, what about getting a message out now? I mean, when I asked you what the message was, I mean, or the tactics, or even the point of doing any of this is, I mean, how much of this is about trying to communicate to a broader community, a greater constituency that is involved in this, whether they realize it or not, through their tax contributions and so on, you know, what about getting the word out?
Yeah, I think even if they didn't broadcast anything about our message, it was clear that we were, the police, the power of the police was useless against us. You know, there are hundreds and hundreds of us. All they could do was let us pass. People were marching to join in the spectacle, and the police did not ask them to turn around. Just simply diverted the torch. And, you know, the people in the march were not even aware. They didn't know that the torch had been rerouted. And it wasn't until I phoned them to tell them I'd heard it on the radio that they were aware that that had actually happened. You know, at no time did the police try and turn people back. They stood back. And I think that by itself sent a strong message that, you know, the power of the people is greater, you know, in numbers like that than even weapons like their sound weapons and their tasers and their pepper spray. They could not deploy those things against the crowd.
Well, what about this now, Zoe? I mentioned this briefly to Janine before calling you about the weaponization, the paramilitarization of police forces across this country, led, of course, by the RCMP, which in turn takes its lead from, it seems, the United States. You know, we talked a couple weeks ago before this event, and privately, I mentioned that I'd seen this massive RCMP vehicle and was quite amused when you said, yeah, I know it. It's parked right outside my house. What's the story behind this vehicle, and why was it so near where you were living, Zoe?
Well, it was parked outside the West Shore RCMP detachment, actually, and I'm quite close to there in Langford. It's an armored semi, and apparently it is for their SWAT team. So it's a massive armored vehicle. And it showed up here about 2 weeks ago and has been parked out here more or less constantly. So, yeah, that was part of the parade, actually. They had a parade of these massive diesel-spewing trucks as part of the torch relay, so that joined in. And, yeah, I'm glad that they didn't deploy any of those weapons. It would have hurt a lot of innocent people, and we were just exercising our rights. I thought it went very, very well. And like I said, we've been getting hundreds of letters and messages of congratulations and support. And this is just the beginning, Chris. The 100 days of dissent and defiance across the country. And it may not be greeted by these kind of protests everywhere, but there will certainly be some more memorable protests to come, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Vancouver. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca around the world in Shoutcast. I'm speaking tonight with Zoe Blunt. Zoe, if you've been listening, was intimately involved with the activities here on Friday and other activities. I focused against the 2010 Olympic Games, or at least, if not against it, well, I mean, using this as a backdrop for some greater social ills. What is it, Zoe, about the Olympics movement that you and so many others find so repugnant?
There's a lot of things. One is that they're spending just obscene amounts of money on this spectacle when there are people suffering in the streets. There are cuts to health care and education and even amateur sports. You know, the cuts are going across the board. They're hurting people deeply, and I think that they are costing lives. And they can, even the paramedics today, I was listening to the paramedics speak about this impending strike, and there's legislated end to the strike. They're saying the government was willing to spend all kinds of money to get, pay overtime and bring in extra paramedics and pay them very well to attend the torch relay. But there's nothing to provide them with long-term security in their contracts. They claim they don't have the money for that. Well, the money, as the spokesperson said for the union, he said the money went to the Olympics. Where does that leave the rest of us? So that's a major problem, you know. And when we look deeper, when we look at why is the government doing this, we see a lot of corporate sponsors. We see Canwest Global as a corporate sponsor of the Olympics, and Royal Bank, and Coca-Cola. And these are, you know, terribly destructive companies, especially Royal Bank with its investment in the tar sands, Canada's most destructive environmental project. This is causing climate change. It's destroying the quality of life and the environment for people downstream. It's actually causing cancer and other illnesses for people who live downstream from the Alberta tar sands. And this, these companies, these are the people, these are the corporations, I should say, these corporations are the ones that are going to be making all the profit on this. Even businesses in Vancouver, you know, are seeing losses as a result of road closures and rerouting of traffic and tearing up the streets to prepare for the games. So they're making these profits from the rest of us, right? They expect to make a return on investment from greater advertising, bringing in more investment dollars. So we would definitely encourage people to boycott the Olympic sponsors, boycott Canwest Global and Royal Bank and Coca-Cola. They are some of the worst companies ethically around the world. Canwest Global is, of course, fighting bankruptcy and has even gone to the extreme of sending some of its reporters and producers to carry the torch. So their journalistic integrity is certainly compromised there, I would say. You know, they're sponsoring the Olympics at the same time as they're reporting on it. And, you know, they're doing a fairly good job of the reporting, but I still have to question why would they be putting so much money into this when they are having trouble keeping their staff?
Well,
yeah, yeah, staff. I guess they're bound by contract, and they hope to make money on it at the expense of the rest of us.
Well, I thought one of the most telling images I saw was a paramedic that ambulance that, you know, was there in case something should happen, with the on strike thing on the back. Our paramedics here have been without a contract for ages, and of course the provincial government is abusing the Essential Services Act to just as an excuse not to go to the table. Which I don't know why arbitration isn't automatic in those cases, but it isn't. Well, I do know why, because then it would take away the leverage of having essential services when you're doing contracts for the government. But
right.
Zoe, when you the corporate connection, okay, these corporations, they're doing a lot of nasty things. A lot of corporations do. Is that the IOC, the Olympic, the International Olympic Committee? Is that their business? I mean, they're just taking sponsorship where they can get it, aren't they?
Yeah, and it's really unfair that they can come in and impose on Canada the way they've been doing, impose on the rest of us. It's a foreign entity, and they're really warping some of the, not only the social and spending priorities, but also even some of the legal and fairness priorities in Canada. We've seen that the courts found that the IOC was discriminating against female ski jumpers, but it also found that they couldn't do anything about it because of the IOC is not based in Canada, and apparently they have carte blanche to come in here and break the law and violate the charter. We were very concerned that they were going to, that the police and the RCMP were going to assist them in that and actually remove people's signs from the vicinity of the torch route. That didn't happen. And so we are seeing, I think our campaign has been very effective. We've seen the police soften their stance and backpedal away from the very harsh line they were taking initially, saying that they were going to take signs and prevent people from expressing any dissent. They changed their tune very recently.
Well, I'll give the police credit where it's due and how they managed the thing last night. But by backing off, now in Vancouver, there's these so-called free speech zones, and there's also bylaws that have been brought in that are definitely counter-constitutional, as you described, that if I'm in Richmond and I've got in my window, I don't like the Olympics, the police reserve the right to come to my door and in 24 hours notice, you know, boot the door in if necessary to take down my sign. Likewise, if I'm standing on the route in those jurisdictions, I can be arrested for having a T-shirt that says, you know, the Olympics should go somewhere else and so forth. But that was challenged by the Civil Liberties, Liberties Association, and I think that is why they're backpedaling in Victoria. Is there any indication, Zoe, in Vancouver that bylaw is going to be struck down, or if it's going to be watered down, or if the police over there are going to try to enforce it?
What they've been saying in the past week or so is that, oh, we're not the sign police. We're not going to come into your house. You know, they actually accused us of fear-mongering, and we're like, hey, we didn't write the legislation. We weren't the ones who were banging the drum and, you know, playing these games about telling people that they could actually enter without a warrant, without any notice. And so that's how the rules are written right now, and they are in the position of either enforcing them or not enforcing them, enforcing them in accordance with the charter or violating people's charter rights. And it could be a very expensive settlement if they do violate people's charter rights. So, yeah, I hope that they're paying attention to what we're saying about that and paying attention to their own legal counsel and not blindly marching to the orders of the Olympic Committee. These people, you know, have one objective, and that is to promote the Olympic brand. The Olympics are arguably, you know, the world's largest corporate brand. And we don't, that's not our priority. We have to stay here after the Olympics are gone. And we have to pay for it, too.
Yes, yeah.
So I'm glad to see that there may be some giving way there, that we will, you know, the only way that we can defend our charter rights is by asserting them. Mm-hmm. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, well, I understand that Montreal just this year managed to finally pay off the 76 Summer Games.
Right. 3 years later.
Yeah, there you go. And then what the interest rates were on that, I don't even want to guess.
And, no, and what was sacrificed, you know, in order to pay all that debt?
Well,
Vancouver is going to be in the same position, and so will BC and the federal government. We're all contributing, even if we didn't vote for it, even if we don't want it.
Well, you know, I recall, I'm old enough to remember the games in Montreal, and there was a Potemkin village of sorts created in the way of these plywood barriers to the poorer neighborhoods. I won't go so far as to call them slums, but the poorer neighborhoods that were found to be unsightly along the entrance route of the Grand Parade into Montreal. They put up these borders and painted them prettily. In Vancouver, we've seen that there is, now I don't know if I can get sued for this. I mean, is there, Zoe, a official program of clearing the streets of unsightly people and things that might embarrass the city in the international eye?
Yeah, well, they're definitely clearing the secured routes, the traffic routes, the official, you know, transportation corridors for the athletes. They're clearing those of, yes, everyone is being moved along. That started, I believe that's starting this month, or possibly even a few weeks ago. They're going neighborhood by neighborhood and implementing these security zones. And people are being removed, regardless of who they are or what they're doing there, in order to, you know, secure the area, shut it down. Yeah. They're denying that it's a program of social cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see, you know. And I'm very interested to see what happens with the Women's Memorial March for the Missing and Murdered Women on February 14th. And I think that, you know, we're doing the right thing, though, by putting Indigenous rights issues and missing and murdered women and these urgent social priorities first.
Well, yeah, and I can't help but think back to Harriet Nahani, who died in custody, or shortly after being in custody, an elder,
right,
a native elder who was up at the Eagle Ridge Bluff,
Ridge.
And
right,
arrested because they were mowing down a sacred wooded area there for the highway connecting Whistler for you know, using the Olympics as an excuse to do this, and
right,
just doing it without the proper environmental assessments, or at least ignoring
right,
the results of those things. How does, and we're fast running out of time, Zoe, but how does Indigenous rights and the missing women in British Columbia, how does that tie in with the Olympics? I mean, is this just using the Olympics as a springboard for other events? And is that fair if that's
right,
the case?
Right. And we've seen, you know, that they are trying to showcase British Columbia as being a fair and equitable place. And they're putting First Nations people on stage with their artwork and so on. And we don't see a lot of First Nations people in the audience participating. We don't see, aside from those few that are benefiting, most groups are not benefiting. And we just concluded with Indigenous Sovereignty Week across Canada, and the Indigenous Environmental Network is calling for days of action against the Olympic sponsors in order to highlight the fact that the government is not recognizing and reconciling with Aboriginal rights and title in this country.
Well, Zoe, it's, as you say, there's 100 days yet, and I know that there's there's a lot more coming and a lot more to be done, and I'm hoping
right,
that you're going to keep me and Guerrilla Radio attuned with what's happening and as this thing unfolds, and I know it's going to be interesting, and I hope that you'll come back and tell us more in the future.
Right. This is only the beginning, Chris.
All right, Zoe. Well, now, oh, yeah, the website, Zoe,
no2010victoria.net.
Check
no2010victoria.net.
If you're computer capable, check that out. And those are numerals, 2010. Okay,
right,
Zoe, thanks a lot for coming on the show again.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, bye-bye. And
bye-bye.
I will also thank Allison Ware. Remember, she's going to be here this Thursday at the BCGEU, November 5th, 8 o'clock is the scheduled beginning for that. That's 2994 Douglas Street. Thanks to Janine Street News, working hard on the next issue of the Street News and her show, 11 a.m., Winds of Change, right here at CFUV. I want to remind you, especially jazz fans, as I play myself out with another cut from the new disc in their Mad Love, To stick around for jazz, Arnold's coming straight up with rhythming to rhythming you into this rather autumnal-looking autumn night here in Victoria. Until the next time.